Welcome to this edition of Back to Basics with Pastor Brian Broderson.
Everybody's afraid to die. This is the great dread. This is the great fear that man lives with. One writer put it this way. He said, death cast a shadow over the entirety of life, hovering like a ghost over every dimension of existence. That is what death is like. It just hovers over every dimension of existence.
Today on Back to Basics, Pastor Brian continues his study in the book of Hebrews. Join us as Pastor Brian resumes his teaching on Hebrews, chapter 2, verses 5 through 18, in a message titled, Why God Took on Flesh and Blood. Now, here's Pastor Brian.
Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For indeed he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Therefore in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are being tempted. So we see Jesus, who for a short while was made lower than the angels. He is crowned with glory and honor after suffering and death. Now, the Son, or as he refers to him here, the captain of our salvation, it says that it was fitting for the Father to make the captain of our salvation perfect through suffering. Now, as we go further, we're going to see all of this is related to the bigger picture of what he's wanting to talk about here. And let me just say this before we go there. The message, I've entitled the message, Why God Took on Flesh and Blood. Why God Took on Flesh and Blood? Because that's really the question that's being addressed here, or it's the question that's being answered. This is obviously a question in the mind of the readers. They're still baffled by this whole thing of the incarnation. How is it that God, why would God do this? And so the author is explaining this. That's what he's doing here. And so he says, it was fitting for God in bringing many sons to glory, that would be all of us who believe in Jesus, in bringing us to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through suffering. Now, the word captain here, the word means the source. You could translate the word the leader, or even the pioneer, somebody who paves the way for others. So Jesus is the one. He paves the way for us. He paves the way to what? He paves the way to glory. God's bringing many sons to glory. Jesus is the first one to go through that process. But he brings him through it, it says, through suffering. And it says that through this, he is perfected. Now, this is perplexing to some people. How is it that it says that Jesus would be perfected? How does Jesus need to be perfected? That's a good question. And what we need to understand is the perfecting is not referring to any moral perfecting. Jesus was perfect. He didn't need to go through any kind of a process to become more perfect in a moral sense. He was sinless, and so he had no need for that kind of perfecting. The perfecting here refers to a what you might call a vocational perfecting through suffering. It's a vocational. He's going through this suffering as preparation for his position in the future. What's his position going to be in the future? It's going to be to mediate between God and people. That's what he does today. There's one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. But he goes through the human experience, including suffering, so that he can mediate effectively, so that he can sympathize with those that he's mediating for. So the perfecting is, like I said, it's more of a vocational perfecting. It's like the priest in the Old Testament, they had to be qualified to serve in their office as priest. And so Jesus, this is qualifying him to serve as the priest and the king. The priest is the mediator, and he's mediating not from the position of simply having information about our suffering, like he can see it from a distance, but he's mediating from a position of having lived it. That makes a big difference. You know, if I come to somebody, if I'm suffering and I come for consolation or help or counsel or advice to somebody who's never suffered a day in their life, they see my suffering and they might even be sympathetic and they might want to say a good thing or two to help me out, but it's difficult. They've never been there. They don't really know what to do. You never have that problem with Jesus. You see, Jesus, he doesn't just know about suffering. He doesn't just know that you have suffered. He suffered also. So when you come to Jesus, when we come to him with our problems, whatever it might be, we're coming to a person who knows exactly what we're dealing with because he was there. That's the amazing thing that the incarnation did, and that's what the author is wanting them to see. That the whole thing of the incarnation, the whole thing of the Son of God becoming a human being for the season was not a sign of weakness. It was a sign of goodness on God's part. It was a sign of grace on God's part. He did it for our benefit. And so he goes on and he says, for both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will sing praise to you again. I will put my trust in him, and again, here am I and the children whom God has given me. So he goes back as his method here. He quotes again from the Old Testament, showing that the Old Testament had predicted that the Messiah, who is God, would become one with us to the point that he would refer to us as his brothers and sisters. He would take on that same identity with us. And notice he says that he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified. Now, sanctification, that's a word that describes the process that we go through in life of becoming like Jesus, to put it simply. The process that we go through in life, all of life, once you come to faith in Christ, you're justified and you enter into this process of sanctification that will last the rest of your life. And during the sanctification process, God is working out the old things and he's working in the new. He's working to obliterate the old man and to bring forth the new man created in the image of Christ. That's what he's doing. But while he's walking us through this long process, he's the sanctifier. We are the sanctified. But again, he's doing it from the standpoint of having been among us. So you see, when you think about this thing of sanctification, this, to me anyway, this makes it so much more beautiful, in as much as the one who's doing the sanctifying, he's gone through these things himself. So he knows what the best possible thing for us is that's going to accomplish the sanctification without destroying us in the process. You know, if God were to just come along and say, I need to make you holy right this second, that could be extremely painful. That'd rip you to shreds, you know, possibly. Because God's going to rip all the sin out of your life. That's what sanctification is. God's getting the sin out of our life. Now, like I said, if he just came and did that just instantaneously, that this would be very painful for all of us. But he does that. But he does it from the standpoint of one who knows where we have been. He does it from the standpoint of one who has walked in our shoes. So you see, the author is showing them that far from the incarnation being something that lessens the glory of Jesus, if you will, no, the incarnation magnifies the glory of Jesus. He condescended to this place because of his love for us. Now, in verses 14 through 18, and these are the ones that I want to focus on here as we kind of get into the primary thing that I want to focus on, and the primary thing that the author is wanting to drive home is really an answer to the question why God took on flesh and blood. Have you ever asked that question yourself? Have you ever struggled with the whole concept of the deity of Christ, God becoming a man? Many people have struggled with that. The Jews, of course, struggled with it back in the days of Jesus. They still struggle with it today. I was just speaking to Jewish friends in Israel recently, and some of them were telling me, you know, still one of the big stumbling blocks for the Jew is, how could God become a man? Why would he do something like that? God's so great. And if you talk to a Muslim about the whole idea of the incarnation, in their mind, no, it's impossible. God is too great. He could never become a man. So why did God take on flesh and blood? He's going to answer the question here. But maybe you've wondered yourself. When I was a relatively young Christian, and I remember going through a season where I was under intense spiritual attack, and it really centered on this whole issue of the person of Christ and the deity of Christ. And I remember the enemy would just relentlessly pound my mind with this kind of thing like, you know, well, come on, you know, God really becoming a man. I mean, how could that be? And why would that? And I'll never forget opening my Bible to Hebrews 2:14 and reading this passage here and suddenly realizing this is why. This is the answer. Hebrews 2:14 gives us the answer to that question, why God took on flesh and blood. Inasmuch as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. That's why God took upon himself flesh and blood. He took upon himself flesh and blood so that he could die. God can't die. God's eternal. But there has to be a death in order for sin and the devil to be overthrown. So how is this going to happen? Men can't die for this because men are guilty sinners. Angels can't die for this because angels are angels. They're not related in that sense. So there has to be someone who has this connection with both God and man in order to do it. And man, remember, is created in the image of God. You know, angels are not created in the image of God. There's nowhere in the Bible that says angels are created in the image of God. It says men are created in the image of God. We only are created in God's image. So there's this already existing link between God and man that is unique. And so now, in order for sin and the devil to be dealt with, God has to die. He can't die. What does he do? He partakes of flesh and blood in order that he might die. And that through dying, he would destroy the one who had the power of death, that is the devil. I was talking to somebody after last service, and just in the conversation, he used this term, and it was good. And I grabbed onto it, and I said, yeah, that's the exact right term. He mentioned the fact that in doing things the way God did them, in sending Jesus to beat the devil by dying, he beat him at his own game. Because this was how the devil, this was his thing, death. Now, when it says that the devil had the power of death, we have to understand that the devil did not possess control over death inherently. So this wasn't always the case. This became the case because of his seduction of mankind into rebellion against God. So when man rebelled against God and sin entered in, and man really in rebelling against God yielded himself to Satan, the great rebel. This is how Satan gained the power of death. So death is held by the devil in a secondary and not in an ultimate sense. But the reason the devil has power over death is because of sin. So if sin can be dealt with, then that power can be broken. The Puritan writer John Owens, he put it this way. He said, all Satan's power over death was founded on sin. The obligation of the sinner to death gave Satan his power. The sinner is obligated to die. That's the way it is. By one man, sin entered into the world, and death through sin. And so, as he said, the obligation of the sinner to death gave Satan his power. If this obligation was removed, Satan's power would also be taken away. And that's exactly what happened. Jesus destroyed the power of the devil over his control over men through death by dying, but he dies sinlessly. So the devil has no hold on him. So he breaks the power of the devil. I think this is really beautifully illustrated by C.S. Lewis in his Chronicles of Narnia. In the book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Anybody read that book, or maybe you saw the movie? There's a part there where Lewis really captures this whole idea here. And just for those of you who don't know, or maybe those of you who need your memory refreshed, you have these different characters in the series. You have Aslan. Aslan is the king. He's the ruler of Narnia. He's Jesus. Lewis was writing all of this as a spiritual allegory. So Aslan is Jesus. You've got the white witch, who's obviously the devil. And there's a certain point, maybe you remember, where Aslan is actually slain by the white witch. And he's slain because he puts himself in the place of Edmund, who had sinned and created all the problems. So anyway, Aslan, he allows the white witch to slay him, and then he resurrects. And he's slain on what's called the stone table. And at his resurrection, the stone table is broken. So let me pick up in the actual story itself. Aslan is speaking. He says, the witch knew the deep magic. There is a magic deeper still, which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she had looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backward. That is such a beautiful picture of everything that we're talking about here. That's exactly it. Jesus is the innocent victim. The willing, innocent victim who has committed no sin. He committed no treachery. And so the table represents the law. The law is what we violate, and it's our violations of the law that put us under the death sentence. And those violations of the law are called sins. So it's sin. So what happened when Jesus died, just like with Aslan here, because he had committed no treachery, the table, the law, is then no longer effective. It's nullified. The table is cracked, and what happens, he puts it this way, death itself would start to work backwards. Jesus conquered death. He destroyed death. He beat the devil at his own game. He came and he died. And when he died, the devil thought, I won. I got him, just like everyone else. But he didn't have him because he couldn't hold him. Death could not hold Jesus. Jesus rose again, and in doing so, he conquered the devil. He destroyed the one who had the power of death. And secondly, he released those who through fear of death, lived their entire life subject to bondage. This is the great fear of all humanity, always has been. It's the fear of death. It's like Woody Allen said many years ago, I'm not afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens. But the reality is, we're all afraid to die. Nobody wants to die. And now, I'm saying that to a group of people who believe in Jesus. So with us, there should be something different about that. But let's just take Jesus out of the equation for a moment and put ourselves out there just in the masses of humanity. Everybody's afraid to die. A lot of people will never admit it, but that's the reality. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to hear about it. This is the great dread. This is the great fear that man lives with. One writer put it this way. He said, death cast a shadow over the entirety of life, hovering like a ghost over every dimension of existence. That is what death is like. It just hovers over every dimension of existence. He went on to say, he said, death means that human beings do not reign, but are ruled over by a foreign power, for they fear their eventual demise that comes inexorably upon them. In every moment of happiness, death is our dark shadow, reminding us that our joy is short-lived. It's so true. It's so true about life. There's always that lingering shadow. And of course, we all try to keep that as far back in our minds as we can. We don't like that to come to the surface, do we? We want to keep that idea as far away. But inevitably, we're touched by it. Inevitably, we hear about it. There's millions of families all over the world today touched by death. It's inescapable. And as a result of that, man lives in the dread of death, lives in the fear of death. But Jesus came, and because of what he did, he releases those who have lived their lives in bondage to the fear of death. So for those who know Jesus, for those who believe in him, we know that Jesus conquered death. And so the Bible now refers to it as the shadow of death. It's just a shadow. The Bible refers to it as sleeping. You know, what's so bad about sleeping? Sleeping's actually really a good thing, isn't it? I love to fall asleep. There's a point. You ever think about sleep? There's two things I marvel at. I marvel at water and sleep. I just think, you know, water is this amazing thing. You can do 1,000 different things with it, and you can drink it, and it satisfies you. It's crazy. You could wash anything with it. You know, all these things you can do with water. But then sleep. Man, sleep is such, isn't it? Think about sleep. You go to sleep at night. You don't know what's going on. There you are. You're gone. You're out. And everything keeps going. Everything keeps working. Your heart keeps beating. All your vitals keep functioning. You know, all of that. And then you wake up and you're refreshed. I think, wow, God, this is just one of those amazing things you created. Well, the Bible says for the believer, that's what death is like. Death is like sleep. But for the believer, death is like going to sleep at the end of a really bad day and waking up to a perfect day. That's the beautiful thing that happens there. So Jesus is the one who sets us free from this. He's the one who sets people free.
For the month of August, Back to Basics Radio is offering a DVD and CD set titled Marriage Essentials by Pastor Brian and Cheryl Broderson. Whether you're married or single, this DVD and CD set teaches essential biblical principles for a fresh and fruitful marriage relationship. Learn how to encourage, esteem, and enjoy one another in marriage in this delightful DVD and CD as Pastor Brian and Cheryl share about their own personal experiences in marriage. The DVD and CD set is titled Marriage Essentials by Pastor Brian and Cheryl Broderson, and it's our gift to say thank you for your donation to Back to Basics. So we encourage you to call us right now at 0208-466-5365 or visit us online at brianbroderson.uk to order this DVD and CD set titled Marriage Essentials by Pastor Brian and Cheryl Broderson. And when you give a gift to Back to Basics, we'll send you the Marriage Essentials DVD and CD by Pastor Brian and Cheryl as our way to say thank you. We do appreciate your generous support of this ministry. We'd also like to remind you that all of our other resources are waiting for you by dialing 0-208-466-5365 or by writing us at Back to Basics Radio, P.O. Box 647, Bromley, Kent, BR14WQ. We'll continue tomorrow with more valuable insights from Pastor Brian as we study together in the book of Hebrews. Back to Basics is the preaching and teaching ministry of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.